2022, tout le monde, antenne, corps étrangers.
Great, thank you. Good afternoon. It's wonderful to be here. Thank you, Olivier, for the invitation. Thank you so much, Louis and Philippa, for your amazing work. I saw your entire film last night, and I'm so pleased that I did, and I wish we had a lot more time to talk about it. I'm very sorry Sana Naabda is not here with us. I thought he was going to be and had prepared some of my comments to be in conversation with him. So they're going to kind of hang in the air and we'll just figure out how to bring them together as well we can. I have a script here just so that I talk slowly for the translators. And here we go. So this talk explores some technologies of seeing, images, categories, terror, representation, to give some historical context, geographic context to what Philippa just shared. And what's kind of ironic, to say the least, is I'm the geographer of the two of us. And Philippa just did a fantastic talk that any geographer would be proud of having done. And I hope I don't embarrass Philippa by trying to be something of an art theorist. But here we go. We're interdisciplinary, I guess. If this talk had a title other than Seeing the Problem, it would be Consciousness, Historical Geography, and the Machine. And I want to start with a question that the literary and cultural critic Jacqueline Goldsby raised in her work on lynching. She says, what if photographs depict what should not be seen? Then what do we do? I have been really inconsistent in my own relationship to this question, to the treatment of photographs, both still pictures and moving pictures, that show what should not be seen. For example, quite famously in 1991, Rodney King was beat up by the Los Angeles Police Department. The film of his beating was shown around the world. And the result of that, which everyone thought would change the political position of the police forever, actually reinforced the political position of the police forever, because the harm did not come with consequences for police at all. That film I wrote a lot about, but never could show at a talk. It was too disturbing to me. And yet, I worked for many years with an organization that works on behalf of prisoners who are locked up in prisons within prisons. So prison within prison in the United States. And there was a series of cases in which prison guards, which is to say police, murdered seven prisoners in full view of the surveillance camera, and the various investigations and trials into those killings every time exonerated, which is to say excused, the killers. My organization took that same surveillance footage and made a film of it in which we dissect the surveillance to show that what actually happened was murder. Well, the people who were not murdered in that prison are still in the prison in the prison. So my relationship to the moving image of people being killed did not result in undoing that kind of harm. So these uses and experiences made me ask myself, well, what did I see anyway? What is it that I think I see? Or to ask all of you, what do you see when you look at images? So I got together with a group of friends, Cedric Robinson, who has since passed away, Françoise Vergès, who is well known to many of you here in Paris, and Avery Gordon, to try to think about what it means to see the problem. And this is some preliminary thinking that I have done on it. I went on an excursion, actually, into the actual mechanics of being able to see. Being able to see pictures and being able to see still and moving shots. And to think hard about what the balance of forces have been in which the capacity to make a film as the raw footage that Philippa was showing might be in order to change consciousness among people who are struggling and suffering and yet also powerful and able to liberate themselves. My meditation, which I call an excursion, led pretty immediately to Kodak, the film company, a multinational film firm, the major employer and patron in the city of Rochester, New York. Now, Rochester, New York is an important place in the freedom struggle of black people in the United States because it's where the famous Frederick Douglass made his home for many years late in his life. And it was also a station on the Underground Railroad. So the one of those stops that people paused along when they were moving from slavery to freedom. Kodak was also the innovator that, above all others, democratized photography in the 19th century. In the post-World, I'm going to skip that. At the same time that Kodak struggled to maintain its profile as an especially beneficent firm, it paid really great salaries and benefits, but was very reluctant to hire black people in Rochester. It faced a challenge, and this is in the 1960s, it faced a challenge to its color film. Lorna Roth and others have written a series of articles on this matter, and I'm indebted to their diligent research that included interviews with people who worked at Kodak. The color issue, which every dark-skinned person can attest to, made color photographs not the joy they could be for light-skinned persons, and nearly impossible when a mix of skin tones gathered for a single shot. Now, Kodak didn't invent color film, but as with most of its products until late in the game, it innovated early and successfully to dominate markets on price and quality. Kodachrome film was the popular standard from 1935 forward. Kodak changed the film not because of people, but as some of you probably know, because of chocolate. Chocolate manufacturers had perfected a range of preparations that allowed them to form chocolate in a variety of colors and shapes. And they wanted to be able to advertise this chocolate in glossy magazines where color print, the cost of color printing had dropped significantly in the 1960s. So the chocolate makers, supported by racehorse owners and other purveyors of shiny dark things like furniture manufacturers, compelled Kodak to change its emulsions so that dark and light together in a single picture could be seen. And as an aside, my reading excursion into Kodak and chocolate pointed me toward another company town, Hershey, Pennsylvania, where Milton Hershey, the founder of the Hershey Candy Company, who was a local benefactor, turned out to have been stealing the labor of the orphan boys who lived in the Hershey orphanage to work in his factory, while at the same time he used the profits from his chocolate company to provide scholarships to the not orphan, also working class boys from the town. And there you have, in a nutshell, Extraction. Chocolate and unfreedom have a long history. While I investigated the sordid history of this delicious food, I stumbled on an astonishing artifact. And this is an artifact, so it's not information. It's a thing. In the March 13th, 1897, March 13th, 1897 issue of the magazine Scientific American. There was an article on three things over three pages. Color photography, the possibility thereof, the possibility of thought transfer between humans, and how to end slavery in Africa. These three things show up in these three pages in Scientific American. The report on color photography considered it might be a hoax, but the reporter accepted the evidence presented before his eyes. He saw the picture through the process and could not imagine how some stealthy fraudster could have hand-colored the image while he was watching it happen. So he accepted as a matter of scientific faith the possibility of color imagery. Seeing for him was believing until or unless made false. Then the brief and enthusiastic article on the possibility of thought transference encouraged the scientifically inclined to consider how illogical it was to assume humans had limits that could not be overcome in the form of, for example, a sharing of thoughts. Right? So this was the second scientific moment. The third, ending slavery in Africa. Ending slavery in Africa was, of course, the Berlin Conference's cover story a decade and a half earlier. At the behest of Portugal, the imperial powers of Europe and North America got together and piously ratified the treaty to end slavery in Africa that even the US signed. And it took effect in April 1892. So I'm 68. I was closer, the year of my birth was closer to that treaty than I am to my own birth. The Scientific American's source on African slavery was a man called Elie Chatelain. Elie Chatelain was a Swiss-born business agent. So if you have read Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, you know that Marlowe, his god, his narrator, was a business agent. Elie Chatelain was a business agent like Marlowe. He, however, brought the New Testament to the region of Africa where he worked, Southern Africa most intensively. He wrote grammars of local languages, which was quite a pastime of evangelists then. And he took copious pictures in the stereographic mode of the last decade of the 19th century to prove his claims. And some of you probably know that the Quaker family that owned Cadbury chocolate in the UK had also investigated slavery, especially in São Tomé, another Portuguese colony, where at the time, which is to say again at the end of the 19th century, nearly every arable inch was planted in cacao trees. About 70% of chocolate today is sourced from West Africa. The plant's entire history is disputed, but apparently it originated in a climate specific to the Amazonian rainforest and then was traded up to Mesoamerica, so traded north to the middle part of that part of the Southern Hemisphere. And that trade was by pre-Columbian merchants, imperial forces, or both. Then European growers established plantations in Trinidad and Tobago and elsewhere in the Caribbean, and then moved it steadily eastward to West Africa, and then to South and Southeast Asia. Cacao can only grow in a very narrow band straddling the equator. Like cotton was, and sugar to an extent remains, cacao is labor intensive. Plantation control throughout the 19th century consolidated, both due to forces I can't discuss in this talk, and because of the tendency toward industrialization, reversed, and most cacao today, like most food that most people on the planet eat today, is grown by small producers, who, however, sell to only a very few processors, who then sell to manufacturers whose number one country of location is, of course, Belgium. The cause of slavery in Africa, the pictures of her in this story, the causes of slavery in Africa were not, however, King Leopold of Belgium, or the Cape to Cairo Railway Plan, or Portugal's desperate effort to cut a swath from Angola to Mozambique. Rather, we learned in Scientific American, the causes of slavery in Africa were Islam, paganism, witchcraft, and immoral white men. So, the remedy, this is where the science comes in. Establish Christian missionary industrial agricultural towns. Lock out all the forces that are conducive to unfreedom by, we must presume, locking the residents in. And of course, disciplining them to working for a wage. So rather than we don't want to work at all, work for money. The vision was modeled on the same thinking that led to the establishment of Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, and Booker T. Washington, the founder of Tuskegee, who was himself born a slave, became free and very powerful. Booker Washington was one of the key people who headed up the philanthropic wing of the legal struggle against slavery in Africa. This sounds very much like now, as Philippa was saying in her presentation. At the same time that Scientific American took up the causes of color photography and anti-slavery, the United States was in full prelude to the American century, achieving by technology transfer, ideological expansion, the control of debt. It became a lender nation, not a debtor nation, and imperial colonial conquest across the Pacific and down into the Caribbean, its modernizing empire. So both creating the empire and stamping on the world the normalization of all of those processes as what the future should become. Coinciding here are three major shifts: the horizontal consolidation and vertical integration of capitalist firms, the development of large-scale, complex governmental institutions developed to guarantee extraction of value from labor and land, so social engineering, public schools, so forth, and the apartheid eugenics dyad used to sort and stack humans. Sort us and stack us. The science of Scientific American as an also not particularly left science of society as a whole, whose integument was and is the organized and ad hoc violence of racial capitalism, again, then to now. In this context, the Kodak firm grew and developed affordable, not to everyone, but to enough people, affordable cameras, film, and printers. So again, we're in the last part of the 19th century. By 1888, the Rochester Optical Company's postcard printer could turn out 1 to 1,000 postcards anywhere. Anywhere. Amateurs could use it effectively, though having the machine could make an amateur into a professional of another kind. The machine could be taken to a school, or a wedding, or a lynching. Jim Crow laws, which is to say American apartheid laws, enforced U.S. apartheid by way of organized and ad hoc, though not unorganized, violence. Everyone whose work I've read on U.S. lynching writes something about a man called Henry Smith. Henry Smith was lynched in Paris, Texas, in 1893, 125 years ago. The representation of his murder, and the crowd that gathered to avenge the death of the child he was accused, but never convicted, of raping and murdering, took the form of both still pictures and moving pictures. Right, 1893. The still postcards depicting him on a platform surrounded by thousands and thousands of people were colored by hand in workshops. Think about that. I haven't learned yet, but I want to learn what that was like to sit in a workshop on an assembly line, filling in color in a specific area of a postcard that is a depiction of the torture murder of a person, and passing it along. What did they talk about? My guess is it was women who did this work, that it was extremely low wage, long hours, bad light. As Jacqueline Goldsby writes about lynching photographers, especially black picture-taking men, so some of the people who recorded the lynchings were themselves black, and as Goldsby speculates about the people who sent postcards with handwritten comments to friends and relatives, I wonder about those people participating in coloring the postcards, thinking and talking about what it was they saw and how that experience reverberated down the generations, even if their great-grandchildren have no idea their great-grandmothers did this. The record of Henry Smith's torture murder was thick. Not only was the event, which lasted a very long time, hours and hours and hours, photographed in minute detail, it was also sound recorded, 1893. By a year after Smith's death, one could see a display of pictures and listen to his screams and groans on a street corner in Seattle, Washington, thousands of miles from the site of his death. 1893, the year that Smith died, was the year of the Columbian Exposition, right? The big World's Fair in Chicago. The establishment of the white city. Everyone and their cousin has written about this. He writes about race, empire, the United States. Cedric Robinson, who was an original and crucial member of the group I described to you who started thinking this stuff, argues that film appealed, motion pictures appealed, as a way to see the unthinkably different, rather than to make endlessly repeatable something from the stage. I.e., he argues, and I think others have as well, film is not the theater by other means. It's completely different, although it's visual and performative. Okay. By the end of the first decade in the 20th century, one could pay a nickel, 5 cents, to watch the torture murder of Henry Smith as a film. The pictures linked and set in motion on a roll, also innovated by Kodak, with the sound playing in sync. "Hear his groans," read the advert board in New York City. I mentioned that Ailey Chatelain showed many stereotypic pictures with his talks to various geographic societies to illustrate the truth of slavery. Let me skip along. Everyone who writes about lynching periodizes 1890 to 1940 as key. Though before 1890, of course, lynching occurred. Henry Smith died once, alone, tortured, in horrible and prolonged agony and unthinkable fear, while thousands watched, smelling his burning flesh, hearing him scream and 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 scream. But then he seemed to die again and again. For decades he kept dying. As so many people murdered by the police today, here in Paris or in the United States and elsewhere, whose deaths are captured on iPhones or other democratized forms of cinema. They die over and over and over and over and over again. Now, it's foolish to think that pictures, images circulating today cannot become levers of power that make people who are sick and tired of being sick and tired become able to do something else. But to do what? And what about the other eyes watching too? What do the images do? Here is where I was going to, and I have, 2 minutes left? I was going to turn to the work of Sanaa Dah and the cadres from the PAIGC to think a bit about how revolution is presence in the materiality of being. And as Philippa showed us so eloquently in her presentation, Cabral's agronomy gave him particular, if not unique, insight into what the materiality of being could be. Not only was, but could be. And it's, as an aside, it's kind of well known among geographers that agronomists tend often, wherever they are, to embrace revolutionary programs. I think it's because of the level of detail of human-environment interaction that they encounter, that they start to see that for things to be otherwise, way more has to be otherwise than what form of tilling the soil an agricultural program might take. The second point I'd like to put out for discussion is that recording what cannot immediately be seen, as the PAIGC cadre did, might give us some thoughts in revisiting the history of photography, color photography, moving pictures, and so forth, to think about how the lag in time between the production and the use of the work make possible, but not certain, shifts in consciousness that then can become productive for social change. The third point I'd like to leave us with is that distance isn't necessarily geometrical, that the amount of geographic space over which the various empires we are the children of in one way or another spread have produced these geometrically discontinuous places where, in the gestures that Olivier was talking about, certain kinds of self-emancipation continue to happen, we should discuss. And finally, that solidarity is radical dependency, each one to each one, across time space. Thank you for your attention.
To react now, just before us, when I propose a response, is it? Is it something?
Thank Merci beaucoup pour ces deux interventions vraiment passionnantes. Je vais plutôt parler au sujet de l'intervention de Philippe. Non sé si c'est que traduce en portugais, non possible. Non. Ok. Parce que je ne parle pas l'anglais. Enfin,
pas assez bien. Elle a un casque, ça va.
D'accord. Donc, j'ai trouvé vraiment fantastique cette histoire de, enfin, cette analyse de la pensée de Cabral du point de vue de son travail d'agronome. J'ai juste été un peu étonnée que vous mentionniez qu'il est guinéen parce qu'il est capverdien et que son premier, le deuxième travail qu'il a fait, ça a été justement sur l'érosion des sols au Cap-Verdu, à la colonisation. Et c'est important parce qu'il a imaginé une chose extraordinaire qui a été de lier deux pays qui sont distants de, je sais pas, enfin plusieurs centaines de kilomètres, mais reliés par la colonisation portugaise. Le Cap-Vert et la Guinée-Bissau, et son parti s'appelle le Parti africain d'indépendance de la Guinée-Bissau du Cap-Vert. Mais c'est juste une remarque. Et c'est aussi pour ça qu'ils ont utilisé le créole, qui était la langue commune aux deux pays. Ce qui m'a interrogé, c'est que vous nous avez montré des images formidables, qui sont des images miraculées, des images que vous avez été une des premières à redivulguer. Et que, bon, moi je peux reconnaître, je reconnais certains personnages, etc. Peut-être même je peux reconnaître à quoi ça fait référence. Mais vous, vous n'avez pas du tout parlé de ça, et donc je n'ai pas compris pourquoi on passait les images. Enfin, si j'ai compris, je vois le lien, mais j'ai trouvé un peu dommage qu'on ne parle pas plus de ces images. Et juste pour terminer, et ça a à voir avec la deuxième intervention, le premier film colonial portugais qui a été tourné dans les colonies a été tourné à Saint-Tomé, dans une fabrique, enfin dans une culture du cacao, pour répondre à une campagne de Cadbury qui accusait le Portugal de mettre en esclavage, ce qui était vrai, les travailleurs de Saint-Tomé. C'est un film de 1909 et je trouvais ça... Enfin, donc ils se sont préoccupés, c'était une histoire de chocolat et d'image. Voilà.
I'm not going to argue if Cabral is Guinean or Cabrian. I don't enter that kind of discussion. Because Cabral was born in Bafata in Guinea-Bissau, but then he lived all his life in, until 16 or very early age in Cape Verde. And so I'm not arguing if he was one of, I mean, I know there's a big discussion about whether he was Cape Verde or Guinean. So I don't think it's relevant. He was willing to bring these two countries together. And make a country like so. That's why the PIGC is called the Party for the Liberation of Guinea and Cape Verde. It's true. I told in the beginning. I'm not going to comment on the images. The black and white images. They are the first ones are from 75 in Cape Verde. It's actually the moment where the country is liberated, and there was not a war in Cape Verde, but there is this big event of this a moment where the PIGC makes a big demonstration, and there's Pedro Pires that became the president of the country talking. And there's other images that are from the jungle war, so we have that two moments. But I said in the beginning I'm not going to comment because I wanted two images to operate also in their level of relation. So this erosion of the images is also something that speak to us, and that was I didn't want it to that was what I wanted to convoke here. So I didn't want to make a kind of historical gesture of telling you when and what. I mean, there's a lot of moments where these things were done, and actually also in the context of this big project that Sananada and many others and I myself did on the archive was often that Sana would take or Sana or Flora would take that gesture of commenting and saying what the images are. So I'm like, my wish to have them here was more less to explain them than to have them as a kind of a imminent convocation of the erosion of that of that cell-like matter. And it's not a disrespect for myself of the content of these images. I just wanted to. It's just another way of operating or like of a use of the images, because the violence that you can see in the erosion of these images for me is also a text. It's also information. The fact that for a long time, for 40 years, these images were in the process of completely. Renage, or a process of constant composting. So I want to see in this composting the possibility of doing something else. So that was my proposition here. What was the next question? But I think now it's for you, I think.
My comment or question is related to the presentation on Russia hospitality. On Russia hospitality, yeah. So I was wondering, in all of that reference to James Baldwin and the movement between the US and Europe, I was wondering how much of the Euro-American hegemony trajectory is taken into account. Because the truth is that there's a possibility, at least the way, you know, the work of James Baldwin is read today and again co-opted, there's a possibility to say that, you know, James Baldwin and his experience in Paris was propped up by the fact that he's American. Or he was American. And if you put that in the context of the hierarchy in the order of blackness that we are seeing today, then that becomes problematic. So again, I wonder how much of this is considered within so who's this post-racial, racial hospitality for? Which black? Who's blackness? So basically, that's what I wanted to.
Yes, thank you. This question is really important because first, I think that when you arrive in America, blackness is not about black condition, it's about African-American condition. And when you come from abroad, from Africa, from Europe, you think that you're going to live an experience of a black community, but you understand that the significant black just relates to an African-American experience. So what is interesting is that it's an ambivalent experience, what you can live, of course, in America, a kind of the reality of a racial, of a democracy rooted in white supremacy. So the police, the administration, doesn't make any difference between the black skin of an African, the black skin of a European, African European, and the black skin of an American. But the fact that the way blackness sometimes can be restructured by the African American themselves is an exclusion. So you have all this ambivalence. And what was interesting for me was not to say, for example, wasn't to talk about this hegemony, but it was just to deal and to understand how we do understand the question of blackness here when we confront it to the writings of Baldwin that are rooted in the 60s, that are rooted in a moment where he doesn't talk a lot about Algeria, he doesn't talk a lot about all those movement decolonizations, and he built a kind of a Paris city as a way, as a safe space for him. And it's interesting to see how Paris, even in Ta-Nehisi Coates' writings, is seen as a safe space. And I just wanted to try to, not to promote, because it is a toxic idea, really, but I just wanted to see how in a city that tries to, in a country, the country of the universal, that erases all the time all the marks, the patterns of the race, how sometimes it can be seen by many people who are racialized by the power, how race can become a safe space. And this is a toxic idea. The people would say that perhaps it is a racist idea, but it is not, because it recognizes that it is toxic. But it is interesting to see how, when you are when you have to face police brutality, I would say systematic racism, how the question of race become not only a question of a structure, but the question of the how we can build a safe space. And my aim was also to understand another toxic idea, which is which was destroyed, I think, by the writings of Césaire, that you can't build an emancipatory process directly from the fact of the oppression. That is to say that you can't deduct, you say deduct in English? Thank you. You can deduct, from the police injuries, the fact that something like a black community exists. Because I think that the black community does not exist, that there is no black people, that there is no black nation. It is something that you have to create. But the dream you have when you face police brutality is that you can perhaps leave something like a racial hospitality. It's a toxic political dream. I don't know if I was clear.
Well, it became complex.
Oh, sorry. That's my English.
Not English, but it became a bit drawn out. But my thinking about it is that this whole emphasis on Paris, and I wonder if this is where this is supposed to be playing out. I mean, the trajectory of Frantz Fanon, for example, Frantz Fanon was Algeria, you know, Paris. So it opened up something, you know, to us. You know, so, you know, the way we are talking about James Baldwin and even Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, and then bringing it back to Paris, I wonder if it is, you know, relevant at all.
We live here.
Yeah, I know, I understand, but
we live here.
Yeah.
But, I come from...
Yeah, but then for me, it feels a bit more like co-opting that narrative, really, because I think it should be operating elsewhere. I think it should be operating in a different context. So bringing James Baldwin, and we know that there's a bit of, you know, the privilege of being an African American that he came with. So I wonder if it is not like co-opting that, especially, or, you know, reinforcing this hierarchy in the order of blackness that is oftentimes promoted by Africans in the diaspora. Let me just add that also.
Can I just answer just one last thing? Yeah, I'm sorry. But it's not the racial hospitality is not a dream, a privileged dream. It's not an African-American dream, I would say. It is, an Afro-European, French dream. That is to say that people have just taken examples from people not living in the center, but living in the peripheries, that are just facing the police brutality. And in fact, what we are trying to do now is just to see how, for example, race, it's toxic, I know, but how race can become just a sign to find new allies. I would love, when I am in the city, for example, to say that all the black people in this city, well, we all know that something like blackness does not exist because there are shades of blackness, and sometimes the people who are black are not seen as being black. We all know that. That's why it's just a kind of it's just a projection, an onirical political projection, this idea of racial hospitality. But what I am just trying to say is that in this ambivalent context of a city trying to erase all the characteristics of the people, we call that the universal, you can have a kind of a political dream called racial hospitality that tries to gather all the people that have to face the injuries of police and of racism. That's all. It's not a dream of the privileged, it's just a way to live into toxicity.
I will try to play the mediator here, which is not a role I play usually, but I'll try to do that. I understand completely where Emeka is coming from with the good idea, and truth be said, there is a kind of hegemony of discourses on blackness that is very American, very It could also be very Euro-American, that is a fact, okay? But I think that it doesn't negate the referencing. I don't think it's a co-opting. I think it's a referencing of Baldwin. And it could be Baldwin, it could be also many other people, you know? The importance of Paris as a place, wherein certain discourses of religious as présence africaine, and all the discourses that were created within these spheres, you know, with Senghor and others, you know. So Baldwin is an example, and so on. At the end of the day, I think we shouldn't get distracted from what is at play here, which is, and if we go back to Ta-Nehisi Coates, when he says, race is the child of racism and not the father. You know, at the end of the day, what we should be thinking about is what constructs that idea or that thing called race, you know, and what do we do with it? You know, so it is, I think it is there at this point that we should be thinking and having mentioned the fact that there is definitely hegemony, the question is what do we do with it? And the proposal is that we could take it and we could reflect from it, we could make a political project out of it, you know, which is, I think, what you're proposing, you know. And again, also looking at blackness, again, that's something Anthony talks of quite often, as a political agenda, also beyond race as color, you know. So how do we do that? And I think that becomes very important. But can I say, respond to...
Yeah, I would like just to try also to come back also to that question of images, because I think to try to continue what you said, not to take another direction, to try to unfold that direction, dealing with images, because I think it was really fascinating to listen to what Philippa proposed about, in a way, a kind of really practice of liberations, but we see that practice through images. And what Ruth is talking about the kind, let's say, a kind as a poison chemical things in the matter. So the question, what is possible with a tool? What can we do with images? I think it's really a question that relates also about creating, inventing a new place. It could be an hospitality, and Russian hospitality, why not? But is it possible with what kind of tool? And I think that what is super interesting in what you propose is also a certain way, not only, as Philippa said, only document an event, but also experiment the matter of the document. And with Cabral, it's super interesting that he's going from the soil as a concrete thing, you know, to make agriculture, but also the soil as a poetical thing. And I think it's really central, because I think that kind of thinkers gave us perhaps the two things we have to care about, and it's not only one. You can only create a poetic of the black hospitality. You have to make it really concretely. But if you don't create any poetic of it, it won't function at all. So there is that back and forth in between, really often, and it's really often between, let's say, artistic or cultural producer in one hand, and let's say anthropologist in the other hand. Not just to quote some, I won't quote his name, but I think a really famous American anthropologist, a really super clever person, say, okay, now he's working with Saramaka's people, and perhaps somebody knows him, and so he says something about, Glissant, and said, here now, it was on Suriname. It says, here now, here are the real Maroons people, for real. They fought and now they got the place for real. It's not a kind of poetic thing, as we saw imagined. But I think it's a problem because it's both. In fact, we need completely to struggle, but we need to create poetic also as tool to continue to struggle. Takabainga says something that the struggle never ends. That means that at the moment you create your hospitality, you are immediately have to dream of another hospitality and continue, as you say, to run away from your own project. So I think like that. And I think there is something that I would like to really say something about that.
Okay.
thank you. And this is such a great conversation. I'm very happy to be part of it. I think that the making and making again is really key. And the sorting and stacking into hierarchy is the given that we're struggling to knock down. And one question that I have is, how materially does that actually happen? So, for example, Cabral, one of my favorite theorists, who, as Felipa said at the end of her talk, you know, was a very humble person, and humble and hummus are, you know, have the same root, and root is in ground, did not pretend that experience added up to victory. He didn't pretend that. That experience without the mediating force of consciousness, which is what Lisson is writing about when he writes about poetics, in my view, means that to create something new doesn't mean to lift up what already exists, glue it together, and call it different. So the creation, for example, of a people, of Cabo Verde, or Cabo Verde and Guinea-Bissau, was not to go back to something that existed before colonialism. Although drawing from the various submerged and also on the surface practices that pre-existed mattered for the possibility of making something new. And I guess that's what we're talking about, all of us, over and over and over again, is making something new. And I'm not convinced that objectively Baldwin and Coates get us there, although I was very moved by your presentation because we could see so clearly in your analysis the somewhere Baldwin and Coates thought they were when they got here. But rather, you know, their capital L liberalism suggests that the remedy exists in the dominant structure rather than that the dominant structure is the problem to which counter-hegemonizing forces must be focused.
Wanted to pick up from Bonner's comment relating to something that I talk about, which is political blackness, in relation to this, in relation to your ideas on racial hospitality. I think coming from a collective where there's myself and Kojo from, you know, originally from India and Ghana, but being brought up in London, I think it's kind of important, it's kind of taught me that it's important not to self-police what blackness is and what it can be. I think people kind of tend to forget that in South Asia, the British called Indians who were poor, basically, they used the N-word against them, and the term coons was used, that they killed, the British killed, you know, something like 30 million people, 40 million people over the period of, meaning within different uprisings and insurgencies, but also, you know, just if you look at the amount of people that were killed due to famine or whatever, people forget, a lot of people forget that, you know, this kind of happened. I think within the, and this also kind of means something very different in an American context to a British context. I think in a British context, there was a moment in which the idea of political blackness, at least for me growing up in the 80s, meant that you could be Irish and also be black. So there was a question around what, there was a sense that this racialization was a trap, and that actually political blackness was about understanding the construction of what racism was about. Going into an American context just recently, I was kind of almost my knuckles were wrapped by some young black curators in the museum of ICA in Philadelphia for daring to call myself black, or using this term political blackness, because in their experience, you know, they haven't met that many South Asians who are, you know, who want to be categorized as black, because Hindus and are a model minority in the States. Hindus, even in India now, even the most lefty ones, do not want to be considered black. They don't think of themselves as black. They want to, you know, sit with the white people in the room, like my dad would call them BBC Indians. You know, so, you know, I mean, there you have a sort of extremely racist, screwed up society, you know, South Asia. Extremely racist. So I just think it's, one has to keep coming back to this question of what is political blackness, I think, in order to remind people of, let's say, ongoing continuous alliances and political friendships, and political friendships that have upturned the capture of what race is about. So I think it's... I think I do also get irritated by the spectacle of African-American-ness in the art world, because it is so moneyed, you know?
Just a word by and what I would like to do this morning, because yeah, you will have a micro.
I'm not talking about African American. I'm talking about how we can live a kind of experience of racism here and in Europe, in Paris, and how we confront, it is interesting to confront this experience to the categorization that you can have in the African American world. And second, I don't mix together political blackness. For example, as a political project, I think Césaire was perfect, because the way he thinks about blackness, or even, you don't even think about blackness, but you just say, we have to find allies, that's all. That's how we create politics. But the thing is that what is interesting here is to see how sometimes you can have the dream of a kind of the ontologization of the look of the policeman on your skin, and the dream is, I would love to find in all the people that are seen like enemies by the police, a community that can exist. This is how we could think kind of an experience of blackness here that has nothing to do with the categorizations of what we can see in the African American world. That's different, and that's why it was interesting to think about it through the writings, perhaps, of Coates. I didn't talk about a lot about him, but of Baldwin and all the way they were projecting dreams and things on Europe and on a certain image of Paris.
So I just wanted to add a little bit to what Olivier was talking about, the politics, because the part of the text that I didn't manage to read you today was actually the old moments where Cabral, where you can read how science and its politics and poetics come together, and I give you just an example, because I have all these like different examples of his texts that I think they bring also something together with politics, poetics, but also the strategic situation of the war. Everything comes together. One example that I could give you, for example, is the way he says we have to rename certain things in our country, because, for example, there is almost no rivers in our country. There's only two rivers, and this idea that he says the Portuguese put names in our rivers and call them rivers, but they are not rivers. They are arms of the sea, for example. And how seeing that this gesture of renaming, this poetical gesture of renaming, the river to our arm of the sea is also because the Portuguese have no experience, geographical experience, of the alluvial land, a land that is flooded and dependent on the tides, and that is the case of Guinea, as like where 70% of the land is always under this kind of permanent change. And for example, he makes this kind of gesture. He said we have to rename many things that actually, and also he says that the difference between a river and the arm of the sea is that the arm of the sea, the salty water enters the land. It's not the sweet water that exits the land and goes to the sea, but it's in the other direction. And with this direction, also the threats came in. You know, the Portuguese came from the, you know, from the Atlantic, from the water, and in that direction. So it brings together also the issue of like during the war, the Portuguese also were entering the countries through the rivers and with military boats. So how he put together the situated knowledge of the people, the need to rename, to recode words and to create a new lexicon, and also how this is all together. You know, the aesthetics that is produced, the poetics that is produced, the strategic efficiency that is produced. So everything is gonna, and I could give you 10 examples in this text about this particular, that I think it's a tool. We can think about these things today, because it's like we can recreate, we can, in each place where we are, if it's in Kiasma, we can create the language that is needed to understand the place and to create a channel. So I just wanted to add that, because this part that actually my favorite part in the talk was completely out, but it's actually the poetics that I wanted, where I wanted to arrive. So I pass this poetics issue to the
answer. Yeah, before I come back to you, I just wanted to make a very fast statement. You know, the way Ruth ended her talk, you know, and she talked about distance is not geographical, which I find extremely beautiful, you know, and passed on to geometrically discontinuous spaces and issues of solidarity and each one teach one, which I find very important, you know, especially in the discussion we just had before, you know, taking a few steps back to say at the end of the day, the issue is to be about solidarity, you know, and because the same forces that produce race are the same forces that produce gender, are the same forces that produce class, and so on and so forth. You know, if we look at Aníbal Quijano's Coloniality of Power, you know, where he expatiates on that very beautifully, you know, how coloniality produces these different aspects. So the solidarity has to be within the construct of race, but also on so many other constructs that were products of coloniality, you know. That said, I want to come back to Cabral. Again, very beautiful, very strong, and a couple of things that, you know, in speeches of Cabral, you know, he says, we Africans believe the dead remain living at our side, you know. And he talks about, you know, our people at the mountains, when he talks about the guerrilla, you know. So we don't have the mountains, but the people will become the mountains for this guerrilla warfare. Amazing, you know. And then he talks about the soil, you know, he says the being from which the soil derives is the rock. So the rock is the being. So you're looking at it, it's a very important thing. So what we haven't talked about here, we're talking about geography, biology, activism in the sense of a kind of a political sphere, and so on and so forth. But what we haven't talked about is spirituality. So this soil is extremely spiritual. It's extremely deep, you know. And I wanted to conclude, I mean, there's a lot to talk about. I was taking a lot of notes, but listening to you, of course, one cannot avoid thinking about Birago Diop, the great Senegalese poet, you know. And his more than important poem, Souf, you know, breath, you know, and I want to read a bit of it, you know, which, because it resonates
so strongly with what Cabral writes about, you know. And he says, listen to things more often than beings. Hear the voice of fire, hear the voice of water, listen in the wind to the size of the bush. This is the ancestors breathing. Those who are dead are not ever gone. They are in the darkness that grows lighter, and in the darkness that grows darker. The dead are not down in the earth. They are in the trembling of the trees, in the groaning of the woods, in the water that runs, in the water that sleeps. They are in the hurt. They are in the crowd. The dead are not dead. Listen to things more than beings. Hear the voice of fire. Hear the voice of water. Listen in the wind to the bush that is sighing. This is the breathing of ancestors who have not gone away, who are not on the earth, who are not yet really dead. Those who are dead are not ever gone. They are in a woman's breast, in the wailing of a child, in the burning of a log, in the mourning rock, in the weeping of grasses, in the forest and the home. The dead are not dead. Listen more often to things than beings. Hear the voice of fire, hear the voice of water. Listen in the wind to the bush that is sobbing. This is the ancestors breathing. It goes on and on. It is extremely beautiful, you know. So that space, you know, soil becomes those ancestors. You know, so it takes a particular meaning, you know, an attachment to land. So when you think of Ken Sarawiwa, you know, fighting for the land of the Ogoni people, it's not okay, it's not biology. It's something else, you know. It is the ancestors, it is the people, you know. Which it's a way I want to relate to your work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.